Back to my place. Whatever you do, he says rather ominously, don't spend the night in the square. So he takes them home with him. He feeds their donkeys. And after they've washed their feet and kind of got settled in, they have a meal together. So far, so good. So why again is this the sewer of Scripture? Oh yeah, because while they're eating, a crowd comes knocking on the door. A crowd of troublemakers from the town surrounds the house. They began beating on the door, and they demand that the old man bring out his guest so they can know him in the biblical sense of the word, for the adults. We'll figure that out. We're expected to hear overtones here in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and Lot's experience there. And then just like Lot does in Sodom, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis, the old man says to his countrymen, and this is a quote from chapter 19, oh friends, don't do such an evil thing. It would be shameful. But he proposes an even more bizarre arrangement. He says, in a very self-absorbed solution, listen, don't do that, friends. This guy that I just met, this guest in my home, you know, that would just be so revolting. But here, take my daughter and take this man's girlfriend instead. Do whatever you like. Don't do such a shameful thing to this man, they say. Well, they wouldn't listen to him. So the Levite then takes his girlfriend, pushes her out the door, and the men of the town abuse her all night until finally at dawn they let her go, and she comes back to the house and she collapses in front of the door, dead. And what does the caring and loving husband who pushed her out the door do? He takes her home, packages her up, and sends her UPS to the 12 different tribes of Israel. Special delivery, everyone. And so chapter 19 ends what, for the first time in the book of Judges, is a very interesting statement from the people of Israel. For the first time, we've been through all of these cycles where people fall into sin, they totally reject God's laws, God sends an opposing army or country to oppress them, and then finally they cry out to God. But they kind of cry out to God really because it's just getting really bad. Finally, here in Judges 19, somebody has a wake-up call. They see how bad things have gotten in their culture and all things that transpired. And listen, how bad was it? Listen to Judges chapter 19, verse 30. It says this, everyone who saw it said, such a horrible crime has not been committed in all of the time since Israel left Egypt, several generations now. Think about it. What are we going to do? Who is going to speak up? Finally, after 19 chapters of this, they've reached some kind of a breaking point, some kind of a tipping point in their culture and in their souls. The horror of what's happened in this town and to this Levite and has just, it stirred something in them. And so they say, what are we going to do? Something needs to be done. And here I think of advice from a noted theologian. See if you can guess the author of this quote. That's all I can stand. I can't stand no more. Anybody recognize that? Noted theologian Popeye. That's right. That's all I can stand. I can't stand no more. You remember, Popeye is this quiet, spinach-loving dude. And then there will come a time, usually after Olive is in trouble or kidnapped or experiencing some danger, when he would get to the place where he would say, that's all I can stand, I can't stand no more. And then he'd pop his spinach and then bulge his muscles and then he'd go out and watch out whoever had, you know, decided that Olive was going to get taken off of them. The bad guys would get what was coming to them. And Bill Hybels, a leader in the church in the States, writes a book called Holy Discontent, and he calls that feeling where you get to that place where you say, that's all I can stand, I can't stand no more, he calls that holy discontent. The place where something breaks inside of you and you cry out like Popeye, that's all I can stand, I can't stand no more. And he challenges people to ask the question, what can't you stand? What is it that you can't stand? That something rises up in you and says, that's all I can stand, so I can't stand some more. Is it injustice? Is it extreme poverty? Is it racism, homelessness, HIV/AIDS, immoral business practices, dysfunctional churches, bad music, crooked politicians, young people drifting further away from God. Like, what is it that inside of you, it has to get so bad that you wake up and say, that's all I can stand. I can't stand no more. Because we're kind of conditioned in our culture, aren't we, to run away from when we get close to that feeling. Like, yeah, it's bad. I don't know what I'm going to do. It's big. It's ugly. Someone else, I hope someone else is really dealing with that problem. But sometimes, like the people in Judges chapter 19, sometimes something inside of you reaches a breaking point where you say, that's it. That's all I can stand. I can't stand no more. Something has to be done. Somebody must speak up on this issue. And I don't know what that is for you. I don't know if you've experienced that at all. But sometimes when you think about that, when you push into that zone, it's easy to kind of put that off and say, you know what? Yeah, I really feel passionate about that, but this is a really busy season for me. I'm going to do something about that later. I'm going to get involved in that issue or challenging that at another time. I don't want to really think about that right now. It's not really the most convenient time for me. Sometimes we're really quite skilled at getting right to the brink of that and then backing off and pushing away from that. Especially when it's really big issues in the world that are happening. Really big issues that's kind of easy to isolate ourselves from. We say, yeah, something should be done. Someone else, we mean usually, should speak up about that. Someone else should get involved on that front, an advocacy for the homeless here in Langley. Someone else should get involved in combating global poverty. Someone else really should be doing all of those things. And we're kind of conditioned that way. And so this morning we wanted to provide a bit of an opportunity for you to push into that a little bit more, to embrace that feeling of holy discontent instead of pushing back from it. And so we've got set up over at the side here, and I'm going to ask Tim if he'd head over there now. We've got what we're going to call a Popeye station, where you get to that place, and some of you maybe right now, just as I've been talking, you know that God's put something on your heart, and maybe it's been building for years and years, and you've always said to yourself, you know, I should do something about that. I should get involved with that. I should give towards projects that undertake in that area instead of just talking about it. And so what we've got here is we want you to actually choose now, here and now, to engage with that. Embrace that feeling of holy discontent. Maybe you need to get a little bit more information about whatever that issue is. And so we're hooked up, we're online here, and Tim's got a number of windows open that he can help you kind of direct. Because sometimes you feel, oh, it's such a big job. Who's working in that area? What could I do in that area? And Tim spent a lot of time, he grew up overseas and is part of our leadership team, our elders team, in the area of global mission. And so Tim's done a lot of thinking and reading about all kinds of different issues. And so if you've got something that's kind of percolating in your mind that you say, I need to find out a little bit more about that. Or, you know what, this is the issue. Could you help? I should talk to somebody about that, how I could actually get involved a little bit more strategically and a little bit more intentionally in that. We're going to set the Popeye station up. We've also got the phys ed office open for you. You can sit down and have a little bit more of a lengthy chat if you need to, and then Pastor Keith will kind of help with any of those things. And so if that's you, if you think, you know what, there are certain things that I know that I've reached a breaking point on, and all around your seats there's distributed some index cards. And so maybe you say, oh, I don't know, I'm not that bold, but I do feel like there's something that I need to do. I want you to just write yourself a note there. On that index card, I want you to take it home with you, and I want you to say, you know, I need to call or send a letter to my local politicians, which again, you could do right here, just send it, fill out a form and send an email. You could write a note and say, you know what, I really feel like God is calling me to step out in this area, or with this organization, or with this, and maybe you need some help with that, and so that's what Tim is there for this morning. And so the Popeye station is available for you, and if you've come to a point and you want to do something, but I want to encourage you to do that. Do what you need to do. Write an email. Donate money to an organization. Sometimes you need to talk about it with somebody, receive some good counsel. And so I'd encourage you that if this morning you're feeling that's all I can stand, I can't stand no more, do something about it. And the people of Israel in Judges chapter 20 begin to do something about that. They begin to actually gather together to decide what they're going to do collectively about this horrible atrocity that's happened in their town. and they put together a military campaign of response to go over and take out Gibeah, which is the city in which this happened. So when you look at the math in Judges chapter 20, it's going to be a battle of 400,000 armed soldiers against 700 armed soldiers. So, except that Gibeah's tribe decides that they are going to come to their aid. And they say, listen, you can't talk to our boys like that in Gibeah. Listen, who do you think you are? And they say, listen, this really bad has happened. And the tribe of Benjamin says, yeah, we don't care. We don't care at all about that. You're going to come and attack Gibeah? They are coming to attack us. And so they marshal their troops for a conflict. And so what has begun as a family squabble at the beginning of chapter 19 very quickly has escalated through a city and through a tribe and now to the whole nation, so that the nation itself is going to be engaged in civil war as a result of this conflict and this action. We have 11 tribes now marshaled against one. And here's what transpires. Listen as I read from Judges chapter 20, verses 18 to 28. I'll be reading from the New Living Translation. So before the battle, the Israelites went to Bethel and asked God, which tribe should go first to attack the people of Benjamin? And the Lord answered, Judah is to go first. So the Israelites left early in the next morning, camped near Gibeah. They advanced towards Gibeah, the city, to attack the men of Benjamin. But Benjamin's warriors, who were skilled and were defending that town, came out and killed 22,000 Israelites on the battlefield that day. But the Israelites, they encouraged one another. They took their positions again, that same place they had fought the previous day, for they'd gone up to Bethel. They'd wept in the presence of the Lord until evening, and they'd asked the Lord, should we fight against our relatives from Benjamin again? And the Lord had said, yep, go out and fight against them. So on the next day, they went out to fight against the men of Benjamin. But the men of Benjamin killed another 18,000 Israelites, all of whom were experienced with the sword. Then all the Israelites went up to Bethel and wept in the presence of the Lord and fasted until evening. They also brought burnt offerings and peace offerings to the Lord. The Israelites went up seeking direction from the Lord. And in those days, makes an editorial note, the Ark of the Covenant of God was in Bethel, and Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the grandson of Aaron, was the priest. The Israelites asked the Lord, should we fight against our relatives from Benjamin again, or should we stop? And the Lord said, go, tomorrow I will hand them over to you. So these 10 verses form the next sort of plot progression in this story, but they're very unsettling verses. They're quite an unsettling part of this story, because they ask God what to do three times, in fact, which is frankly quite a lot more than I will often ask God what I should do. And yet, they still have casualties of 40,000 men in battle. How could that possibly be? They're following what we would consider, or the term that we might use to describe it, is they're following God's will, aren't they? I mean, they asked God what they should do. God said, send Judah up. They sent Judah up, and they lost. What do you do when you follow God's instructions and it doesn't go as planned? It doesn't turn out the way that you thought it would. What do you do when you're in the middle of the revealed will of God, but you're still losing 40,000 guys? We were in the middle, as a family, of a situation like this not too long ago. When we started at Jericho Ridge 3.5 years ago, we felt God's call on our lives really strongly to sell our townhouse in Walnut Grove and move into the community here. So we looked around, and after a time, it became apparent that we would be building. And so that was a huge challenge in and of itself. And then things started to go wrong. Things started to go very, very, very wrong on all kinds of fronts, seemingly all at the same time. And I remember in the midst of that, coming back to God and saying, but God, we felt real clearly that we were to sell our house and move to this area. What is going on? This has not transpired as I thought that it would transpire. And I remember real clearly God's response to me in prayer one day. It was real simple and real clear. God said just this, I said that I wanted you in Willoughby, Brad. I never said it was going to be easy. And I think I had this picture in my mind as maybe you do sometimes when thinking about God's will, that, well, we prayed about it, and we seem to get a good response, so that must mean God's just going to clear a path for us. It's going to be nice and smooth. There's going to be no resistance. It's not going to be hard, is it? Because, after all, we're following God's will. I said I wanted you in Willoughby, Brad, but I didn't say it was going to be easy. Is that really what it means to be in the center of God's will? That there's going to be no problems or challenges? Think about Samson. Being in the center of God's will for him at the end of his life meant that he died along with those Philistines. Or Moses. Being in the very center of God's will for him meant leaving an easy job that he'd been doing for 40 years to take on the known superpower in the world and lead a group of unwilling ragamuffins through the desert to a land that he didn't even get to see. Or think about Mary, Jesus' mother. The very center of God's will for her was experiencing the intense and almost at times, I would imagine, overwhelming social stigma and potential stoning that comes along with being an unwed teenage mom in ancient Palestine. And then later on in her life at age, when her son's 33, you get to watch your own son be killed as a political criminal. It's the very center of God's will from there. I hate to be the one to break it to you, but I think that we have a myth in our culture that the quote-unquote safest place to be is in the center of God's will. Have you heard people say that? The safest place to be is in the center of God's will. Here in Judges chapter 20, the nation of Israel comes to God, and at first, if you read between the lines, they treat God a little bit like a magic eight ball. They say, okay, God, what should we do? Should we go up and get him? Magic 8-Ball says, yes, go attack. Send Judah first. Right on. Let's do it. So they go up, and they get beat. Well, they haven't actually at that point yet really asked God in any type of intentional or humble way. They just are so fired up about this injustice that they're going to storm this town no matter what the consequences happen. And so they fall under God's wrath and divine judgment. The very center of God's will for this nation at this time is that 40,000 people experience God's judgment in their lives and in their nation. The very center of God's will for those guys, and maybe for you, is not a very safe place to be. The very center of God's will may mean that you are experiencing a refining or a purifying season in your life. Maybe your spouse needs to find something in your browser history that's going to spark some change. Maybe you need to experience financial hardship to learn something about being thankful in all circumstances, or about generosity, or about restraint, or living within your means. Maybe God's will for you in 2008 and 2009 is a health crisis or a job loss that will accomplish something in you spiritually and in your life and in your family that nothing else will be able to accomplish. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 5 and 6 says it this way. And have you forgotten the encouraging words that God spoken to his children? He said, my child, doesn't seem like encouraging words, my child, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. And don't give up when God corrects you, for the Lord disciplines or chastens, the King James says, those he loves. The center of God's will for you, friend, might mean discipline or hardship or challenge, but it is still the center of God's will for you. And it's something to really wrestle with. It's that very place that God needs you and intends you to be that may be so difficult that we run away from it and we want to resist it at all costs. But don't treat his instructions to you lightly like the people did. Because this, for them, is just an indicator of their larger heart problems. I don't have time to go into the entire story this morning, but it just gets worse and worse and worse. The people completely destroy one tribe of Benjamin. They come up with this plan that involves then the taking of more lives to rectify the situation, and then tricking a group of 200 young girls into being kidnapped by the remaining Benjamites so that an entire tribe does not end up getting wiped out. You can see as you read these three chapters how self-preservation and how self-centeredness and self-interest so dominate everything in the lives of everyone involved in this story that unspeakable evil after unspeakable evil transpires, and it just gets worse and worse and worse. God's justice and his laws are mocked. The weak and powerless are exploited. Those who are in need of protection are sacrificed on the altar of expedient solutions. I mean, this really is, in a lot of ways, just the catalog of stuff that happens in here is worthy of the title The Steward of Scripture. It's as low as it gets in a lot of ways. And at the very end of the book, the author of Judges gives us a clue to the reason why. And in some senses, they give us a clue to the reason or the rationale for the writing of the book of Judges. They want to give us this picture in their minds and in our minds, a picture of what we today would call moral relativism and what happens when there is no absolutes. And so Judges 21, verse 25, in rounding the book off, says it this way, what has been said many times throughout the course of the book. In those days, Israel had no king, and all of the people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes. And the author of the book of Judges is saying to us, friends, I want to give you a picture. In fact, I want to give you a whole catalog of pictures, a little album, as it were, of how bad things can get when everyone follows their own moral compass. When truth is abandoned and when moral relativity prevails. When this happens, you get Ehud's deception. You get Barak's cowardice. You get Gideon's testing of God and his tanking in the later part of his life. You get Jephthah's sacrifice of his own daughter because of a foolish vow. You get Samson's lack of discipline, ruining his life and ruining the role that God raised him up for. You get leaders running after their own self-interest and profit instead of listening to God and carrying out justice for the nation. This is an album in Scripture known as the Book of Judges, and the author seems to be asking us and handing us a gift in giving us this portrayal and saying, is this what you want? Is this the picture that you have of what it means to everyone do what is right in their own eyes? The kind of spiritual and moral and cultural vacuum. And some of you, as you're thinking about it, are saying, well, you know, Brad, in my books, we already have that in North American climate today. And I'm not usually the one that stands up and rails against things. I would strongly prefer that as an individual and we as Christians be known the things that we're for, as opposed to the things that we are against. But know this, there are some things that we should be against, and I would put strongly in that category, based on the teachings of Scripture, moral relativism. It's that philosophical presupposition and system that says truth cannot really be known, it's culturally bound, that it's acceptable, therefore, for each person to create guidelines and ultimate truth for his or herself. And in his commentary on this passage, Younger says it this way, in the book of Judges, as well as in our culture today, moral relativism prevails. And the more that it prevails, the worse the atrocities that people perpetuate on people. It's only in a climate of moral relativism that we can get things like the Rwandan genocide, or Russian troops invading Georgia, or Olympic athletes who are only sorry that they've actually got caught doping, not that they've done it. Or you have in the news this week here in Langley, thieves going out and stripping wires from local churches. And you have kids, all kinds. You just think of a catalog of all kinds of things that happen. The whole gambit of the dark places of the human heart begins to be exposed and give license to go unchallenged when you can legitimize anything. And the author of Judges paints this picture for us in this series of character studies, and then opens it up for discussion and says, is this what you want? Because this is what's going to happen when each person does what is right in their own eyes. And this has largely become the tone in our culture, hasn't it? I think it can be easy in the face of that to throw up our hands and again, just like in chapter 19, say, well, what am I to do? What's a person to do? And I think there's a couple things that I think we could suggest, and certainly this is not an exhaustive list, but one of the first things that I would say in response to that question, what can we do in the face of a culture and a climate of moral relativism? I think one of the first things you can do is equip yourself as a person. Begin to understand it. Begin to understand the arguments and presuppositions that underlie that philosophical worldview, and begin to look at a Christian worldview holistically. One of the things that I can recommend to you quite strongly is a project by Focus on the Family, and it's called the Truth Project. And it's a seminar on worldview that's coming to our area. It provides excellent equipping in answering the questions of moral relativism. And the question that underlies it is, do you really believe that what you believe is really real? I say that a few times. It's a bit of a tongue twister. But I'm going to attend it this fall, and I'd certainly invite you to join me and participate with it in getting more information and equipping yourself on how can I have an intellectual or an engaged conversation with someone, my friend or my neighbor or coworker, about this. There's also great sites. Several years ago we had, for an Easter presentation, Michael Horner here. He's a local professor and apologist. You could take a class at Trinity Western. The Institute for Christian Apologetics, run by Dr. Paul Chamberlain, is a great local resource that you could jump in on, especially those of you who are students. You can take an elective in your program somewhere, plunk one of those in. There's all kinds of books and articles, etc., etc. But I'd just say, equip yourself. Become informed as to the issues that are being discussed in our world and how you can respond appropriately to them. The second thing that I could suggest to you as a response to that is the picture painted in these three chapters of moral relativity really invites and challenges us to live the alternative to that. If every person's going to do what's right in their own eyes, let's get together collectively and stand for truth and righteousness and justice. Matthew 5:16 says it this way: in the same way, let your good deeds shine out for all to see, so that everyone will praise and glorify your Father in heaven. If things are bad, we can stand around and wring our hands and say how bad it is and get all upset about it. Or you can get up and take a stand for truth and righteousness in your home. You can live and do business with integrity in your work environment and employment. You can live what you say you believe. And so as we close today, I'm going to invite Kevin and the team to come back and lead us in a song of response, a song of declaration that comes straight to us from the Old Testament and from the book of Micah. And in contrast to these three chapters, it invites us to pursue that which we know to be true of the heart of God in the life of a person of faith that professes faith in Him. You may know the verse. It says it this way: the Lord has told you what is good. The Lord has set a standard, in other words. And this is what He requires of you: to do what is right, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. The more we embrace this as an alternative reality, even though we're not perfect, even though it might not mean that the pathway of resistance is easy, we live in confidence and authority under the authority of God, who loves us and who challenges us to make a real difference in the world in which we live, in a world that's lost its way. Let's pray together, and then we'll sing this as we close. God, we thank You for Your character, for Your heart. We thank You for Your truth. We know and affirm that it can be known, that You can be known. And God, You call us to live in a certain way.